Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to another Game Dev Unchained podcast episode, the number one game development podcast about game development and the lifestyle thereof. I am your host, Brandon Pham, and with me, a special guest, Mel Kirk. How are you doing, Mel?
Hey, good, Brandon. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Of course, man. Thanks for coming on. This is the part of the podcast, actually, where I kind of ask our guests, which is yourself, about yourself, where you've been, where you're at, and where you're heading.
Sure. Man, I started in games. Seems like it's been like a blur. 2004, I got into the industry. I started working for a PR and marketing firm that was aimed at helping developers and publishers with external marketing resources and whatnot. Just kind of whatever needed to be done back in those days. It was much different than now. But I ended up like helping companies get publishing licenses. Figure out if they should advertise in Game Informer, figure out if they should go to E3, what does a booth look like down in the doldrums of Kensha Hall, things like that. I got in some of my first projects I got to work on were Guitar Hero and Guitar Hero 2 back with Harmonix and Red Octane. I then got to go forward into all sorts of other wild forms of branded entertainment, like a Star Trek MMO. Worked on, Jackass the game for PSP. That was a lot of fun. We actually went on tour, on the Warped Tour with Jackass and the guys, trying to get them to create levels and upload them to YouTube, which YouTube was like a brand new thing back then. So spent 6 or 7 years there, kind of did everything. And then found my way to Zen Studios. And it was a small team based in Budapest, Hungary, very small back then. They were working on a pinball game, which I thought was cool because I love pinball. They needed help with very specific things. I just decided to join the team full time. And I've been there ever since, helping build the company. That was in 2011 I landed there, 2010. And then we were just acquired by the Embracer Group under Saber Interactive. We made that announcement, I think, like a couple of weeks ago, end of November. So it's been a wild ride all these years, working a lot of really cool different things. I think I've got a pretty good handle on pretty much all aspects of the game industry, from coming up with a game concept on a piece of paper all the way through to when you push a button and it goes out the door, and then hopefully seeing it, do well, players, finding an audience and players enjoying it. So done everything in between, all the business related aspects, not so much a designer or a coder, but I do have a lot of input. I've had a lot of input over the years on very specific things in games, which I believe have made them what they are. So that's a bit about me and what I do. there you go.
I mean, that's quite a lot. So we'll go through a bit, right? Business development has always been a curiosity. It's one, like, I'm actually spending a lot of my time now doing that. And it's just something that I feel like a lot of game developers kind of fall into it and learn through experience more so than actual schooling. Is that partly true? I mean, were you learning things on the go, or did you have a little bit of a college education behind it to get things going?
Yeah, I came straight out of university with a business degree and also a psychology degree, which is focused on consumer behavior. And I wanted to get into games. Lifelong gamer, started back in the NES days, PlayStation, and then went through there. And I knew I wanted to work in games, but I wasn't really sure how to go about and get involved. And so really what I tried to do is just latch on to a company that, somebody working in the industry, of course, at the very bottom, and then always just raise my hand and just say, I can do that, or I'll figure that out. Because this was a time when things were developing pretty quickly. And you take in case the product like Guitar Hero, where the box is way bigger than you know, what games are traditionally sold as in jewel cases, and it costs a lot more than a game. It didn't fit. And so we had to be really creative about how we sold the game into retail, or how we were going to do the marketing and the communication for it. And really, there was no precedent for how that was done. So I was doing a lot of biz dev and marketing and PR for that. But, you know, my attitude was just, we'll figure it out. You know, that's kind of I feel like an entrepreneurial type of spirit and just a thing. So no matter what sort of book knowledge I may have come out of school with, or, you know, what was going on around us, really there was no precedent. It was very experimental. It was very, let's just try this and see if it works. If it doesn't, we pivot. Thinking fast on your feet, working hard, very, very hard, showing up to PlayStation, literally saying, how do we get a publishing license? I need to do this, you know, and filling it out there in person with a pen and paper. So it was just that some of the stuff I think maybe you can't teach, just the hard work, the showing up, the being there ready to do something. And then, you know, just loving what you do, loving games, wanting to see them succeed. And I think it's done differently now. You know, that was a different time, but now, you know, I think that there's a more straightforward path, more of the, you apply for a job and, you know, you get in the door, you might start in a certain division, depending on the size of the company, you know, the EAs, the Activisions, the big guys of the world, you go through that process. But still on the indie side, if you're scrappy, if you're, you know, entrepreneurial, you understand the web, you understand viral aspects and social marketing and just how to harness the power of the web. Like, I think you can get into a small indie team and show some real value and like really help build a company from the ground up. I still think that opportunity really exists today.
Yeah. I think one of the things about the game industry, and I feel like this in every discipline, more so in business development, is the lack of documentation. And a lot of it is kind of going through and testing new grounds. And especially, being the business guy, you're always trying to get out of your comfort and just go out and ask. And I think there's naturally some reservation about developers not wanting to bother people, or it's like it's too uncool to bother people, where it's like the persistence actually help land a lot of the bigger deals. It's like just making yourself known and your company known to the other interested party or potentially interested party. Was that something always kind of part of your college education? Was it something unique to game development, or anything particular about the game industry that pushes you to kind of push back as much as you can?
Yeah. Well, back then, you know, I would really say nothing I learned in my college experience was practical to the game industry, other than learning how to be organized and maybe learning how to learn quickly. You know, I just remember in school, like, you know, it kind of pushes you to become organized and think on your feet. So I took those things with me for sure. But look, if you're working on the biz dev side, you know, you got to be organized on, in the sense of learning and knowing how a spreadsheet works and keeping track of numbers. And hopefully you're working with a team on a creative vision that is achievable within your budget and within a time frame. So you know, if you do have funding in front of you, you're not exceeding that. And like kind of forcing yourself to go into a position where you have to make a deal, because you're kind of like, man, we're out of money. We're out of time. Like we just have to do something. So that forces you into a position where you don't have any leverage, because you got to make a deal. If you can manage those in the early phase and get a project shipped and have enough sense to move some units and to get going, or to knock on a door to get a publishing deal, you know, I would say be tenacious with it. Don't feel like you're bugging people. A lot of times, you know, especially we've been in the publisher seat ourselves, where we've published games from third parties. And when I was knocking on the door of somebody else to publish our game. So I've seen it both ways. I've always found that like, you're not going to bother somebody. It just takes everyone's so busy in this industry, like trying to do more with less kind of on an ongoing basis. But if you just, you know, try to build a network, you find somebody who gives you the time of day, latch onto that, ask them for advice. Just keep pushing. And you know, I think it's a Hollywood story too. Like, this is kind of, you know, the game industry is young in a sense that we're in a place where Hollywood was maybe 50 years ago or however many it was, but we're accelerating faster due to circumstances, you know, COVID or technology changing and the way that our industry operates. But I think it was very similar. If you have a creative vision, you have a product and you're working on something, it's up to you to make a deal or to make it a financial success. You know, there's no shortage of knocking on someone's door and asking them to take a look, or being, creative and finding a way to get your stuff in front of somebody. So, I don't know if that's answering the question. I think that it's maybe in some cases a little easier now because you can also use influencers, for that sort of thing. If you can, you know, they're almost like, I almost view influencers as somewhat of a way to break in as well. So you got a lot of them with all their different sizes and scopes of audiences. But if you find your path, then, you know, you get some traction, I would say, you know, you're on your way.
I think one of the barriers that I feel smaller teams kind of put up around them is approaching these big partners or potential big partners, and having, like you said, having leverage definitely helps, but also feeling inadequate to even approach the big partners in the first place. Like, how much of that is true? Like, how much do you need to have if you have a great idea, but you don't necessarily have the audience or the people to kind of push that idea across to be like, hey, we can handle your IP and express it in a very unique way, but just lack the audience right now? Like, what is the leverage usually in that kind of scenario?
Yeah, I think it can be different every time. If you're talking about one person and you're working on your own project and you don't have the means to see it all the way through, and so you're looking for, you know, if it's just an idea on paper, that's one thing. If you've got a working prototype, that's another. If you've got a vertical slice, that's another. And if you're just looking for completion funding, that's quite another. All of those have different, you know, different stages to them, and you're going to be received differently by with everything. I would say you're in a much better place if you have a team established or a fully functional proof of concept vertical slice. You know, that's where you probably have leverage to go in and really make something happen. Anything earlier, you might be spinning your wheels. Someone might not take you seriously unless you've already shipped a successful project before, or just can demonstrate some level of success. So the barrier to entry, I think, kind of keeps getting pushed further and further down because games are expensive and they're risky. So having some proof in the pudding or some success to show for it, you're going to do that much better. For somebody who's just starting out and you have an idea on a piece of paper and that's as far as you've made it, I'd say that, you know, you need to do more in order to like really be taken seriously or to try to get a deal done. If you're just a business person with an idea as well, you know, and maybe you've got resources to go hire a team and you get to a point where you create something. Sure. That's a path. Or if you are the creative person, you don't have any business sense, but you really have an idea, you might want to then go find a business person or a BD or somebody who can help you start to put a framework together for what a budget looks like. Maybe go get some funding, raise some money, or, you know, even just get a marketing team behind you to help kickstart the idea. I mean, there's a lot of different ideas and paths, but it depends on where you're starting from, where you're coming from, what stage of the project you are.
I think one of the trend nowadays is cyberpunk, right? And we kind of know the story behind CD Red Project with their Richard series, you know, and it's something I feel like a lot of indie development team should take more advantage of existing IPs and not completely wearing all the hats and trying to come up with a new idea, innovative idea, but using something that is kind of known and has a lot of backing in story and development already, years put into it, and then taking that into a new medium. So The Witcher was kind of like that, where they struck a deal with the author and it was mutually beneficial, but didn't break the bank. And then the rest was history. It still required a lot of hard work, obviously, from the game development, but like they didn't have to sit down and completely come up with the lore that could have been time consuming. And rather they put that effort into the game design. Like that was one in a million type of story where I don't feel like any development is taking advantage of that more often. I can't really even think of another story that's like that. Being the biz dev guy, like how much of a missed opportunity with that type of thinking? Is it mostly out of fear, where smaller teams, like we kind of mentioned, don't feel like they can approach and read a book and kind of somehow, you know, figure out that path, because there isn't really a clear path of doing that?
Yeah, these are great questions. And, you know, Zen has a lot of experience working with IPs in our pinball games, you know, and that's kind of where we established the company. We decided to really focus on one thing and doing it really well, actually doing it the best and just trying to own it. And in that, we work with a lot of different IPs. When we first got started, Street Fighter was the first IP we worked with. And then we went on to Ninja Gaiden. And I think after that, we got to Marvel. Mm-hmm. But the first four deals that we did, I would say, like, those were, I mean, I don't want to say they were bad deals for Zen, because we knew that we were going to have to cut kind of bad deals for us that were really expensive, selling your soul, so to speak, because you have to have proof that you can do it. And if you haven't done it before, they're going to look at you. And in our case, who's this small little studio from Budapest, Hungary? Like, why are we going to trust them with our IP? And are they even going to pay us royalty? And are they good on their word? And can they create the product that they are talking about? So it cost us a lot to do that, but we knew what our roadmap was, and we knew we could do it well. We had already had a little success and we had some money in the bank, so we felt okay making that investment. And that was our pathway to IP with Zen, which, you know, now we don't have to necessarily cut that sort of deal, and we have a lot of IPs coming to us, which is nice. But I do think that there's something to be said about going out and finding an IP that maybe is ripe for interactive and in gaming. There's a ton of source material in comic books. I still think comic books are the number one source for almost everything. Movies, games, there's a lot. I mean, that's where you find a lot of inspiration. And there are a ton of comics that, you know, are just sitting there waiting. And I know it wouldn't break the bank in terms of, you know, getting rights to create material based on those comics. And so that's where I would, you know, I always tell people, if you want to get into IP and you want to start somewhere, go find your favorite comic, or find a story that's just waiting to be told in games and other forms of media. And, you know, rather than trying to go pitch Marvel or, you know, some global IP where, you know, you have to know what you're doing. You have to have some sort of pedigree and proof in the pudding already established to get there. And the resources and the finances available to do that. So yes, IPs are there. The Witcher's a fantastic example with what CD Projekt Red did. I think that there's more of those opportunities. It is harder to get above the noise these days. I mean, there's, you know, so many games, so many things coming out, but IP also helps. If you find an IP with a fan base already, helps lower your cost of marketing and users, right, coming in. So you can introduce something to them that they already love, in a universe that they already love, and hopefully you've made a good game. So that's certainly kind of in my mind, it fast forwards your path to success. But you got to do it well, you know, and IP holders are going to hold you accountable along the way. They're going to have input into your idea, into your vision for the game. And they're going to have a full approval. And so, you know, it might take you longer to get something out than it would have otherwise not working with an IP. But that's what I think would be helping.
And I would love to kind of dive a little deeper in the beginning of Zen Studios and working with these IPs without having, like, you know, the resume to kind of that you guys are enjoying now. Right. So there was a lot of give and take in that type of relationship. And you were mentioning kind of like having a firm roadmap to look at, to refer back to when you are feeling like you're being shanked with these deals, right? I think that's incredibly helpful. Like, what advice do you have for people who are thinking along this path? Because I do agree with you. Like, it is a path that is less traveled for a lot of indie devs, because for whatever reasons, right? But I think it is one of the safest steps if they are, like you said, three games out, where they're thinking forward about three games after, instead of just one hit wonders and betting everything into that, which causes a lot of problems, right? I would love to kind of hear your thoughts about more insight about that process at the beginning, and what expectations you guys had, and non-expectations that occurred during that development.
Sure. So I have to like, you know, back up a little bit and tell a little bit of a story, you know, about pinball itself. Pinball lived in arcades for many, many years. And it's always been a game that's associated with IP. And the pinball machine itself was designed to like immortalize a moment in an IP or a universe that people loved. And there was a lot of mass market, you know, all the big 80s movies and 90s movies and even bands, that they had their own pinball machine. So it's a game that was already well known and recognized, and there's flippers and a ball and people generally get it. There's also been Space Cadet Pinball, which was OEM'd onto Windows 95, I believe, which might be the most played pinball game of all time. And everybody who booted up their computer on the Microsoft OS was playing that game. And so, you know, there's kind of this well-known aspect about it. And we just saw that nobody had done a digital pinball game for consoles yet, or PC that was like really good and monetizing well. So when we identified an opportunity, the first thing we did was we built the game with our own original IP, and we launched it and onto Xbox Live Arcade back in 2007 was the first launch. And, you know, lo and behold, it became the number one game on Xbox Live Arcade. It was a shock to Microsoft. It was a shock to Zen. But it just showed that, okay, here's a game that people want. So we know there's a demand for it. And then we started to turn our attention and our thinking into like, okay, pinball needs to have IP because it's the way it's always been. Well, what IPs are really relevant right now and what's approachable for us in terms of something that won't totally break the bank and, you know, will give us a shot. And so that was kind of our approach to it. So we had our proof of concept. We were already monetizing. We had money coming in. We felt like we could take that next level of risk and make an investment in IP. We had a friend of mine, John D. He was at Capcom at the time. He's now at Arcade 1UP. We're actually reunited now, working on virtual pinball machines together. He was instrumental. Like, we approached him and we showed him the product. We showed him what we thought we could do. We got a deal done for Street Fighter. Now, it's the most royalty we've ever paid. It was, you know, crazy because it's a Japanese company. Very, you know, I would just say Street Fighter was hot at the time, and yeah, you know, commanded the money that we were going to pay them. So we did it. We jumped in and we did it, and it was great that we did, because we felt like, okay, if we can show that we can do a successful table with an awesome license, going forward, we're going to be able to do this with, you know, who knows what. And we had our next, because we had success with the Japanese company, then we went to Ninja Gaiden, but we always had our sights on Marvel and Star Wars and Jurassic Park and things like that. But we knew that we just had to take the right steps to get there, be patient, pay our dues, so to speak. But always focus on the quality product, because licensors want to know that you're going to take care of their IP, but they're not going to have to chase you if you make a bad game and it comes out and it hurts them. And everyone's like, what's this crappy Street Fighter game? You know, like, that hurts more than anything, and that'll kill your chances more than anything. So we were committed to quality product, to paying our dues, understanding the roadmap, knowing that if we did this well, we could own digital pinball and move forward. So we put a lot of eggs in that basket and we went for it. It paid off. And that's a bit about the process that we took here at Zen.
Mm-hmm. And I always equate the roadmap, and I would love to kind of hear your take on it, because being the biz dev guy, it kind of equates to like like a crime scene where they're like seeing the red string connecting to what. And to me, it feels like that's how we should approach and are approaching a lot of how these networks kind of connect, and one step at a time. And it's one of those things where game developers don't have that background into thinking that way, or at least transferring their game design knowledge over to business, where they're taught to think that way. I would love to kind of hear your thinking process behind that. Like, how were you able to, did you look at people? Did you look at the licensing? You said you guys kind of had like your beacon towards Star Wars and Marvel licenses. And how did you draw the string from Street Fighter to Ninja Gaiden? Like, was that all planned from the beginning, or was it kind of happened? And then you're constantly like reevaluating and replotting your roadmap.
Yeah, it's a bit of both. First of all, we had some sales data, right? Like, we showed what happens when we sell games with based on our own IP. what happens when we sell a game based on Street Fighter and Ninja Gaiden. And also when somebody comes in because of Street Fighter, what happens to those original tables that we had, which are our own? Well, we found like, cool, we can go after the Street Fighter audience, pull them into Pinball FX, and now they also bought the Zen original table. So we saw kind of an all ships rise situation. And that gave us kind of some case studies going forward. So when we went to Marvel, we said, Marvel, here's some proof from the pudding. Like, we made a whatever 80 Metacritic game that Metacritic had was important back in the time as well, showing that quality bar. And here's the sales proof. Here's what we think we're going to be able to do with Marvel. If we create a pack of tables, and if, hey, you guys have an FIP, so we can build a universe here. Like, Marvel Pinball can be its own universe. So there's the pitch, putting together the forecast, the long-term range of what this relationship looks like, the product roadmap. We want to do these characters, and oh, by the way, now you have movies coming over here for MCU. Like, what we can get into that. And you just start to put together a big picture plan that they can get behind. You show that you're very specialized and very dedicated to your craft. You know, we go in there pitching pinball. We don't later pivot and say, now we want to make like a Ultimate Alliance game for you. No, like, we don't go outside those bounds. We know what our role is. We know what we're trying to do with Marvel, and we stick to that. And then we get into product development, you know, and it ships, and hopefully you exceed expectation. And then you just continue on working together. And that's why we've been working, like, say, with Marvel for, geez, a decade now. I mean, 2010 December was, we're right here at the 10-year anniversary. As you prove yourself out, you know, you continue on. And then, of course, yes, you're reevaluating the roadmap. You discover certain things. One-off opportunities will show up, like Plants for Zombies, for example, right? It hit, it was huge, PopCap, another, at the time, an indie studio, very approachable. We had mutual friends, and we just say, hey, Zen, you're making the best pinball. Hey, PopCap, you've got awesome Plants for Zombies. Let's do a Plants for Zombies table. And we do it, you know, and that was not like on the map. That was not something that we planned. It was just those opportunities start to reveal themselves to you. It's a good and bad thing. I mean, it can be distracting. It can get you a little bit off your strategy, but then you say, well, we haven't done this sort of a game yet. Maybe it's going to bring us a whole new audience. And it did. It brought us a huge amount of female players, which I believe started then giving the game to their kids. We saw that come in. We saw, sales of everything else go up because it came for Plants for Zombies, but they stayed for everything else. And so, that was just the nature of the game that we found ourselves with pinball specifically. And it turned into us building this franchise, right? Pinball FX became a franchise, which is still going today. And I think that that's another thing that you want to focus on is when you start working on something, you want to be very true and make sure you nail it the first time and make it as good as and awesome as you can. But like, do you see the roadmap for this thing to become a franchise? And can I be working on this 3, 5, 8, 10 years from now? It's a game now. Can there also be merch? Can there be a TV show? Can there be this? That's where game developers find themselves now, is we are creating the IPs and the entertainment that is going to shape, I believe, a long-term future of entertainment at this point. And this is all new thinking. I mean, game developers traditionally haven't thought this way. I think you see the companies who have and have developed these power franchises that just sell year after year. Now it's a question about whether or not they're innovating with those. But once you establish a franchise, I mean, it's worth your while to continue investing and let that compound for you and let that work for you over time and history. On the pinball side, I mean, we've done a lot. We continue to go there, but it's a never ending. Where do we go next? What do we do next? How do we keep it fresh? How do we make it feel like we've done over 100 pinball tables now? There's 20 Marvel. There's 20 Star Wars. Do we need to keep making more tables? And we're constantly reevaluating those. So that's a little bit of an insight into the way we process here and what my job is essentially is to help sort out.
Yeah, and first of all, congratulations on the acquisition. Hopefully, that was I'm guessing that was part of the business roadmap of like acquisition, right? How do you usually plan for something like that? You have a target audience, you're building momentum. Are you also looking at the inner roadmap, like possible potential suitors that this business of yours will eventually be attractive enough for them to consider things? Like, how do you usually factor that in? Is it a lot of research on potential suitors or is it just happenstance kind of culmination of things happening and then opportunities kind of popping up?
I think it happens for companies differently every time. One thing I love to point to is like Insomniac and Sony, you know, they got together and they made Spider-Man, which was a fantastic game, and Marvel was involved and it was an exclusive deal. You know, I think that that made a lot of sense there. They probably figured out that they loved working together. They had long-term interests aligned. They had a great time making Spider-Man together. So that's one way an acquisition happened. You've got a company like Zen, where we're kind of an OG indie, you know, we're one of the first hybrid developer publishers going to digital content, sort of thing, had a much longer path just of finding our way, stumbling, making the mistakes, learning from them, somehow staying in business, maneuvering around changes in technology and all this stuff. Somehow somebody thought, we've had other fish circling our us for a long time. You said, Zen, come be a part here. Come do this. Come, you know, can we acquire you? It's always been about like, you know, I don't know if we felt that this time was just right or what was going on in the industry, what's in front of us, but we just felt like we kind of got to the point where we took this as far as we could go on our own. Mm-hmm. And that we saw huge potential in front of us, exciting potential. We kind of whittled that down into a framework of what we thought it would take to achieve. And we just said, all right, we can do this on our own, but it's probably going to take us another 10 years. And what happens if we just find a partner that can help us accelerate now? And this partner has similar vision, a similar culture, similar, idea of just how we treat people, just all the things that go into because making a game is really, really hard. And then making it commercially successful is hard. So finding that right partner with the right fits and would help us accelerate this vision. And that's what we found with Embracer Group and you know, Saber Interactive. So for us, it wasn't like we were building this to sell it or that was our end goal. We wanted to have an exit. It was just the right time, the right circumstances. Suddenly we were like, okay, we built this thing and it's awesome. Here's where we go with it, but how do we do that? And this will enable us to do it much faster. And I think without like aging, much more because I'm starting to get gray hair. So, you know, that's where it's at.
Yeah. I feel like the internal struggle with indie development or any game developers has always been, the allure of creating your own IP from scratch. Right. And, I would love to kind of ask you guys were experimenting with that, done that many times, as well as having these sure deals, you know, mid and later development where like, hey, this is sure money. It's a good license. And you guys kind of find a happy medium there where you like, these are awesome Marvel IP, Star Wars IP. We love doing this, but there's always that, you know, kind of like, pool for like, you know, I have my ideas too. I would love to contribute to that. Like how did you navigate that with the creative team to find a balance that works for you guys without, you know, taking too much risk, which is always seems to be the deterrent of new ideas?
Yeah. Well, I can answer this now for you in two ways. Now thinking about Zen's non-pinball business, which we do pinball and non-pinball, and that also includes our RPGs. On the pinball side, it was about not taking the risk was actually the risk, because then a game might feel the same, or a player might say, oh, they just reskinned this. We have to be sure that with every new table that we're making, there's a new gameplay mechanic based on the IP that we're licensing or on our own creative idea. But that the core gameplay, for example, like for the Infinity Gauntlet with Marvel, that was an opportunity to go bonkers because, you know, Thanos and all the gems, we could do a different gameplay mechanic around each gem. And one of them was, I believe it was a reality gem where we flipped the entire pinball table upside down. So, you know, that's the first time that's ever been done. And that just wowed people. And they're like, okay, you know, like Zen is really going for it. This is crazy. We always walk a fine line between what can be done in the real world and what is our video game. And so we embrace obviously being a video game to its fullest potential, I believe. But the risk there was like I said, we've done almost 100 tables, making sure that they're fresh and that we're doing something innovative. And I think the risk is not taking the risk. Now on the RPG side, where we're doing, RPGs are a whole different animal. And we've made some really good ones that nobody's known about. And I think that's another reason, you know, Saber can help us with that as well. And the acquisition will help us make sure our RPGs are more known. But a game like Castle Storm back in 2013 was this crazy super genre mashup, we're just throwing a whole bunch of different things together, RTS, RPG, physics-based destruction, Angry Bird-style gameplay. But it was born out of our ability to do games really well with physics, obviously pinball being a physics-based game. We took our physics engine, we applied our love of pen and paper RPG, kind of a you know, a story that didn't take itself too seriously because we weren't really good at storytelling yet. And we started to build out our capability to do RPG. That was a huge risk for us because we are now departing from our core competency and saying we want to compete over here and we think we can do well here. We had this kind of cash engine going, you know, like a pillar in the company that could fund an RPG development. And if we failed completely, we're not out of business. So we waited until we were at that point where we felt like we're not going to kill ourselves if we don't make it. Luckily, the game was awesome. Like Cast of Storm was a, you know, very, it was big success for our company. And then from there, we've gone on to make others. And as there's, it's just been more competitive in gaming altogether. So it's harder to, you know, to market that. It's clear that marketing and selling an RPG is completely different than our selling a pinball table. And we've learned a lot of lessons along the way about that. But there's two different types of risks, right? There's the risk of innovation with something you already do really well, then taking a risk and doing something you've never done before, but you think you can, and you're ready to make that leap and let's see what happens while not completely killing your company if you fail. So we went through both of those sort of risk, you know, assessments.
Another point is that that I love to kind of hear more about is the risk assessment is great. And a lot of it too is about team growth. You know, just maintaining the talent without putting too much at risk by growing the team too fast, right? Mm-hmm. I always attribute to studio success through sustainability more so than those one huge hit wonders, right? I much rather have a company that I adore around the next 30 years than one that, you know, has like a massive explosion of popularity and then is gone the next 2 years, right? Which is a lot of game development studios. So I would love to kind of hear more of your thoughts about that. Like how did you guys balance between the two from, you know, especially with all these IPs coming to you guys and, you know, if we do more, then more money will come in. So the allure of that is always attractive. But at the same time, you know, we have a roadmap. We want to grow the team to a certain degree. We want to maintain the culture as much as possible and focus on the creative more so than just managing people and constantly just having to get them in and stuff. Like, would love to kind of hear the balance of that.
Yeah. You know, Zen has never, we've never had a time in our history where we ramped up for a game, launched it, and then like let people go. We've been conservative in our approach to growth, adding a couple people every year, like finding the right people. And actually turnover at Zen is super low. I mean, really, we've only lost a couple people over these last 10 years, which I think is a testament to the way we manage things. We don't crunch. Like there's been like two or three instances where it was like a month of craziness. But I mean, generally speaking, we try to be Zen in our culture. Like Zen Studios is Zen. We do certain things. Nobody wears, well, back in the before COVID, nobody wore shoes in the office. We wore slippers and just things about it that are Zen. And the culture is very important and sustainability is very, very important. Also, we found, you know, guys were working on pinball games for many, many years and they wanted to do something else. That was another driving decision to start working in RPGs or these non-pinball titles. These guys did have ideas. And team members wanted to do other things. And so we said, well, can't just expect people are going to want to work on pinball for a decade and do nothing else. So that was, you know, part of our sustainability and part of our effort to make sure people were happy and finding fulfillment. And, you know, sure, while we want to grow, we think like all this, like, let's just hire a whole bunch of people, double down, go for it. This has never been our approach. We've always been conservative. We've always tried to make sure that not getting too far ahead of ourselves. We've seen plenty of examples of, like you mentioned, of scale up, build something, it doesn't work, everyone's gone, down to this little core team again, you know. And that, in my mind, like that's harder to deal with than slow growth. I'd rather grow slow, methodically, successfully, make sure people are happy, and this is a sustainable effort. And you look at Zen, you know, like I said, like 2007 published their own game. Before that was Work for Hire, but here in 2020, still going. I think it's sustainable.
Mm-hmm. That's huge. Yeah, I feel like that's a lesson that indie developers Can definitely learn from, because I see a lot of potential where the first idea, maybe the marketing timing and all that wasn't right and the game is great, or vice versa, the marketing thing was great but the game isn't quite there and needed more time. Like, there's a weird combination of those two, but it's always people put all their eggs in one basket for that first game, and it's like, this is a studio that could have been really great three games in. But unfortunately, because of poor planning, they just don't last that long, or the core team gets dispersed, right? And because a lot of the expectations is just too high. It's like, this is your first time doing it, you think you're going to have a hit. That's insane. Most games are like five games in before they actually get the rhythm, right? I kind of want to go back to the history a bit, right? You were talking about getting hired and going to Budapest, Hungary. Like, is there a story to that location particularly, where why the studios is kind of based out of that and was grown from there?
Yeah, there is. So the founder, Jolt, and then the core group of like four guys, and by the way, like all but one of them are still there through all this. Hungary was... it came out of a Russian communist period, and the country economics, demographics, what they had access to was very specific during those times. So while they didn't have necessarily like Nintendo, they had a lot of pinball. They had more pinball machines per capita than anywhere else in the world during that time. And so there was this, that's what they grew up doing. That's what their fun and their outlet was. And so pinball is part of the DNA of, especially the guys who are at our company, their age, their profile when they grew up. And so, so they love it. It's they're passionate about it. It means more to them maybe than most people. So that's where the company was started. Jolt and I were introduced through mutual friends at Microsoft at an event at GDC. I want to say back in like 2006 or seven. That's where we first met. And we stayed in touch. Kind of, you know, I was happy to give ideas, make connections, do things. And then it was this time, Jolt flew me out there. He's like, what do you want to do? What do you want out of life? What do you want to do? And I was like, well, you know, I've helped people make their game successful and just kind of been a whatever I can do to help. But I would love to get more into what is the actual product? What is the strategy? What's the focus and the vision for a company in a studio, and like help build it really from the ground up? And so we just found mutual respect for each other, common ground. We both had a lot of ideas about how to treat people and what it would look like going forward. So I jumped in, and I got to go to Budapest a lot. I love it. It's like my second home, which I've only been there one time this year due to all the COVID stuff. But I found kind of interesting, the Hungarian people, maybe they've been misunderstood in the past, or they didn't have every opportunity. They were kind of hidden away, so to speak. But like, there's so much talent, and there's a lot of amazing ideas and artists and musicians and creative thinkers. So I think that like for the Hungarian scene itself, you're going to see some amazing things come out of there. That's a little bit about the origin, the history. A game called Operencia that we did 2 years ago now, time flies, was about Central European folktales. And this is kind of the first time we embraced our Hungarian heritage as a studio in a game. And so you'll find that game, more than anything, I think embraces what a Hungarian culture and what a game looks like, specifically when you turn that creativity loose, and their flavor of game. So maybe how you would think about how CDPR did in for the Polish game scene is hopefully what Zen can do for the Hungarian game scene long term.
Yeah, I mean, kind of jumping off of that, like the COVID is a. Of course, overall a horrible thing, but like the byproduct of that has been the open arm of the industry to all these kind of marginalized parts of the world that haven't really been tampered or played into as much, right? Like, I feel like now that we're allowing a lot of remote workers, that we're kind of looking into talent pools that we've never looked into certain markets, it's allowing a lot of these talented artists and developers from around the world to kind of participate on a bigger scale and give their perspective. I think that's one of the biggest things. Like, I feel like Japanese market at first was huge, and then the Western, it kind of shifted to the Western, and now we have like a good combination of the two. But then in between that time period, CD Project Red is one of the biggest games right now, right? And it's I think a lot of this barrier of entry is lowering enough that a lot of these developers are finally kind of giving their unique take that we're not used to, because of the big IPs kind of doing the same thing, right? I would love to kind of hear more about your take on how much this is going to affect your industry, other parts of the industry. Like, how do you feel like the remote is going to change our this decade of 2020s that differs from the last decade?
Yeah, we've been learning this on the fly as we go. I told you it was a little scary. Like, okay, everyone's work from home, bring your workstation home, build an intranet, a more secure sort of intranet communication tools. You know, off we went that in March of 2020, and it's been okay. I actually think in some ways productivity has increased because people are just like, they don't have to get up and travel into the office and commute or something. They spend that time actually working and thinking. So in that sense, it's been okay. Projects that were already in gear, already on their way and had their creative vision have been okay. Where we're finding maybe some challenge now is we're starting on some new ideas, new concepts. And it's always nice to be like in a room with somebody, just bouncing ideas off. The creative process is flowing. You got a whiteboard. So that's where I think we might run into some hiccups, or it might take longer, or maybe not be done as well as just like brand new creative process and understanding, you know, how to kick something off and greenlight it. Because, you know, we were used to doing things a certain way. It'd be fun. We could have a meeting, a big long meeting, that we could go out to dinner. We'd go to the pub and like, we could just carry on the conversation and it would morph and it would turn. And now we're just like doing it like this with Zoom, and it's not the same. So we're finding our way there, but yeah, like big picture, long-term, I think game developers are actually adept. And we're maybe the best position to make the most or be able to transition to this new sort of environment, because sort of how we operated already, without knowing it, when a new Xbox is coming, a new PlayStation's coming, or just new technology, whatever, you suddenly have to pivot and you kind of start a new direction and you need to figure it all out, and it becomes new. It's a new environment. It's a new thing. So I think that we've done quite well, shipping a product in an era where, you know, you're not all together, but all the buttons are pushed correctly and all the backend systems are set up and here we go. We published it. We've been able to do it. I think it's true for most of the industry. I think it's pretty impressive. Long-term, I think it's sustainable. I think people are figuring things out. A lot of game designers and people who work in the creative process are, I would say they're, you know, a little more internalized anyway. They're not so extrovert. So being around people maybe doesn't hurt as much, but I do know that there's some people, especially at our studio, that, and we know who they are. We check in with them more because it's like, we were their family. We were their source of interaction. And when they're just by themselves and, you know, maybe they're not married, they don't have kids, and they just don't have a network in their living space, that can be lonely. And so we have to be very cognizant as the managers of the company and responsible for all these, you know, people, to check in with them and make sure that they have what they need to function and to be appreciated. So I think it's all of us, anybody who's in our position is like the management, you know, we're at least at Zen, we're very cognizant of that, and it's important to us. So hope that helps answer the question.
Definitely helps. Naturally very curious about, you know, heads of studios, what they're thinking. And I think there will be some more of a hybrid approach. I think people who lean too far into like Zoom forever, for the rest of our life, is like, nah, man. Like, there is a creative energy that you feel within a room more so than a Zoom room, right? There's just something there that you bounce off. It's a little quicker. This is an option for those who can't be in the same locale. That is the next best thing. And I think a combination of the two is the best scenario for moving forward. I'm going to Tarantino this question, because this is kind of harking back a little bit earlier in our interview, right? You were talking about before Zen, you were working on Guitar Hero, right? And getting that peripheral, a new concept of like peripherals into your living room, aside from the system that's not packaged with something, right? Just packaged with a game. I kind of draw the correlation between, you know, VR kind of having that issue at the beginning and finally starting to get some footing with their Quest 2 right now, right? What lessons do you have from that experience to what you're kind of just your own opinion and perspective of how VR is playing a factor and how people are still somewhat resistant of fully adopting that technology?
Mm-hmm. Well, it takes time, takes a lot of investment in content. I think once you have the killer game that everyone's talking about, that if you haven't played this, you're missing out. You know, that's what it ultimately takes to win people over. I think with Half-Life Alyx, you know, that we saw a moment where it kind of was like this. That was maybe one of the first times where it hit and people are like, you have to play this. Like, it's now mandatory. I look out in the landscape and like knowing some of the VR experiences that are coming, I think that, you know, we'll continue to break down the like that need or just that thinking of like, I can live without this for now. I'm going to wait for something really big to come. I think Oculus is investing a tremendous amount of money in great content in helping there. So as is Valve, I'd like to see PlayStation. You know, I mean, like the Iron Man VR was there, but I feel like they've kind of exited this a little bit. If Microsoft came in with something, talk about VR in the future, I think that would help. But, you know, they have the mixed reality or I forgot the name of their thing.
HoloLens.
HoloLens. Yeah. So I think, you know, AR as well. But like thinking back to Guitar Hero, you know, we focus on the experience. The big thing was, how does this make you feel? Like when you strap a guitar on and you start playing the music, do you feel like a rock star? And like, yes, you do. And that's what we really tried to push. So all of our marketing, the demos, everything was when someone walked in the Best Buy and there was this like homeroom set up for the first time with a couch, the TV, and there was Guitar Hero and you played it. And that was how you experienced it. And you felt like you could see this in your home and how it worked. And you felt like a rock star. And that's really what broke it down. So, it's a little bit different right now, right? If you want to put a headset on for the first time, I don't know if you can in Best Buy. I mean, then you got the COVID stuff and like, are we passing disease around? And there's all the thing about if someone's got pink eye and, you know, how do you cleanse it? So there's some of the same or some different hurdles to jump through. There's got to be that killer app. There's got to be an experiential element in which somebody can feel comfortable in that space and try it. It is nice that there's no more wires and craziness attached. It's really out of the box. You get a Quest 2 now. Out of the box, you got an app, you're on, you're in, you can be playing a game in like 10 minutes. So, you know, there you go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the VR experience is still very a lonely one. Like the mere fact that it's technology requires you to put something over your eyes and just trying to zone out everything around you. It's a very lone experience. I think that's part of the issue there, where it's not a party game where, you know, Guitar Hero was more of like a communal type of experience, right? It is a slower adoption. I don't know what it is. I think Alyx, like you said, is definitely one of those helpful killer apps where I felt like I felt the same thing. It was the only time where I felt people were actually pushing other people that doesn't work for Facebook to go out and get like a VR set to play this game, right? I'm just naturally very curious because you have that kind of background to kind of see, you know, it is a sector that is peripheral based and it's just slowly gaining some grounds. And there are a lot of interests on that in that field. It's just not, you know, developers are kind of like with some reservation, not all in yet. And then thankfully, you know, a big company such as Facebook is the one that's pushing it. But besides the point, we are at the hour mark. I want to thank you for coming on and sharing your biz dev knowledge. I do want to just ask one last question before I hand the mic over to you. So if you have like a few words of wisdom to the indie crowd out there for that solo artist who wants to go about doing something, what advice would you give them to kind of get them started, as well as best practices for plotting out a roadmap that's realistic for somewhat of a, not guaranteed, but some average success where you're not just going out there in the ocean with surrounding sharks all the time?
Well, I would say, you know, work on your network, try to, you know, utilize what it's social media. I mean, like every once in a while, you know, you mentioned an artist. I see this hashtag go by every once in a while. Like it costs you nothing to share my work, or, you know, artists who have established themselves at big time developers will just start sharing other people's work if you send it to them. You know, I think that that's, you know, just getting visibility on your stuff, obviously, is helpful. Having a portfolio that's, you know, easily presentable, sending it to studios. If you're looking for a job or you're pitching a project, like having a presentation that's well put together always helps, making yourself look as polished and professional as possible. So I would say that, you know, back in the day, we used to have the GDCs and all these events of the world. You can go and network or get an interview or whatever. Unfortunately, those don't exist right now, but there are digital events that are trending and popping up. IGDA, you know, the Independent Game Developer Association, you can become a part of your local chapter and start to make inroads. But I think networking is really the key. And just finding ways and creative ways to intersect with people and to hopefully start a conversation. If you're like more of a, you know, if you're an indie studio, you're working on a game, I would say try to, you have to get some business knowledge or IQ. And you have to manage a project and you have to try to ship and you have to have a budget in mind and a target and like try to hit deadlines. I know it's difficult and it can be theoretical, but try to operate like a real functioning company. There's a lot of talks online as well that you can subscribe to or look at. There's the free talks, everyone from like Xbox to PlayStation or to other devs who do these sort of things. Just, you know, listen to the experts, listen to people who have done it before. Don't be afraid to ask questions or to tweet at them or send them something, because I think game developers, people who are successful, actually are inherently tuned to want to help others. Like that's what I love about this industry, is we're all very helpful to each other. We love to share information. I think I'm an open book. Usually when I'm talking, I'm happy to share. We do want to see others succeed. You know, it's something that we hold close to our chest and say, oh, this is the secret sauce. We're never going to let it out. But, you know, I think that we're all happy to help each other. And then, I don't know, I always say this thing, like kind of maintain startup mode to start with. Like it is crazy. It's a crazy amount of work it takes. You have to be driven. You're going to fail a couple times before you succeed. That's just kind of the nature of it. But just having the tenacity to continue on and to learn from those failures and to not get, you know, don't be distraught about it. Just use it as a learning opportunity and just know it's part of the process, and stay with it. So I think that those are some of the ingredients and some of the things you need to keep in mind if you're going to embark on this journey and you want to really, you know, find your way in the game industry. And ultimately one day, like really ship a game that hopefully lots and lots of people can enjoy. And, you know, that's one of the things that I always try to keep in mind, is like, I feel like we're bringing joy and happiness to somebody. And that's something I really want to, I'm proud of and that I want to do. And finding the heart of why you want to do something and make sure that your goals and what you're trying to accomplish is always aligning with those. So that's where we're at.
Well, thank you, Mel, for sharing that. And, as mentioned before, this is the part where I hand over the mic to you to give attention to, a shout out, and to point the good people out there that are listening and viewing this right now, where to go to find you, to connect with you, to talk with you, to learn more from you.
Sure. If you want to follow me directly, like I try to be active on Twitter. Sometimes I go long periods of time without, but I am at Mel_G_Kirk, something like that. Mel G Kirk. Otherwise I would say go for Zen's channels. We're very, very active on Twitter, YouTube, Instagram, Facebook. We always try to respond literally to every comment or question that comes in. So you can find us or any number of our people. I think it's Zen_Studios is most channels. Every once in a while, I'll be tweeting from the Zen Twitter if need be. You'll even see like dash from Mel. So try to be accessible. And yeah, that's where you find us.
Awesome. Well, thank you for spending the hour with me and chatting it up, and hope everything and everybody over there is safe and sound. That concludes this week's podcast. I'll see you guys all next week. Thank you for listening to today's episode. If you are liking the podcast, go to the Apple iTunes store and give GameDev Unchained a 5-star rating. This will help spread the joy and love and exposure for the podcast, and we thank you very much. If you want to continue the conversation, go to our Discord, which can be found on our website, www.gamedevunchained.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at BlueChamps, BlueChamps. You want to catch these episodes live every Tuesdays and Thursdays, go to twitch.tv/blue_champs. Email me any of your concerns or questions that you want me to read aloud at the beginning of each episode at info@gamedevunchained.com. And if you want to further support us and help unlock the next feature, which is the voicemail feature, go to patreon.com/BlueChamps. This gives listeners a chance to kind of call in, leave a message for both me and the guests to answer your deepest, darkest questions and comment on your deepest, darkest secrets. Thank you, everybody.